Hi, and welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a weekly podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
And with us this week, we've got Marcus Haldeman, who's a member of the Django technical board and on the Django security team and, you know, on the Django ops team. He's just a stalwart of the community. Hello, Marcus.
Hi, Carlton. Hi, Will. Hi, everybody.
Hello. Thanks for coming on, Marcus. So I guess, let's kick off. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about yourself, Marcus. Like, how did you get into program? How did you find Django? You know, how long have you been with the community? These kind of, you know.
I've been writing code for, 2 decades now? I'm not even sure. It's been quite a while. And then got into Django 2010-ish as part of the German Ubuntu users.de community. That's a Django project that started even before the days of Django 1.0 or something. It's like 0.90 or something. Like the very, very early stages of Django. That's when that project was started. And it's a support forum for the German-speaking Ubuntu community. And yeah, features a bulletin board and news articles and Planet and all these kinds of things.
Is that still going?
It's still going. It's still maintained by a few folks on all. It's unfortunately not open source. It's a kind of a thing that we since ever talk about. Yes, we want to make this open source, but because it has so much legacy, it's also one of the things where there's a lot of technical depth in there that we want to, or that the folks who work on it these days want to get out of it before they actually open source it.
Were you going to say cruft? Is that the word that was coming to mind?
Yeah, probably. I guess it's...
Maybe that's the kinder of the words that start with CR, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
But that's just any old code base, right? Any old... Like, so that's what, 10 years old, 15 years old, coming, you know, that's an old code base.
Yes, I think they started writing that... And I wasn't on the original team, but they started writing that 2006, I believe. And it's a project where then, as a side effect, like Werkzeug, Flask, Jinja 2, all those projects came out of. It's kind of in the, well, not early stages of the Python web part, but I guess the Django-ish style web development part.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. Yep. And that got you into Django.
And that eventually got me into Django. And there's Apollo 13 is on that team as well. Or was back in the day, was on that team as well. And then he eventually kind of like always pushed me a bit to maybe contribute to Django. Because at that point he was a core contributor as well. And yeah, that eventually got me into contributing to Django after Andrew Godwin merged his migration patch in 2014, I believe. 13, 14, 13?
Well, 1.7, right?
1.7, exactly. And yeah, then I contributed bug fixes there every other day or so.
Yeah, because when tickets come in on the migrations, I always wince a little bit because they're quite hard. And I'm always quite glad if Marcus comments or, you know, a couple of other people. But Marcus is one of my core... you know, go-to people on the migrations framework.
Maybe still. I unfortunately didn't have the time for the last few years to actually do a lot of things on the migration framework. But I think it seems there's a bunch of other contributors these days that actually have picked up behind me and behind Andrew and others that contributed on a regular basis and like squash out all these bugs these days.
Yeah. So you please go on, Will.
I was going to say, I'm going to put a link to all the various teams on the Django project site, because I think you have the record for being on like all of them, right? So there's, and again, and this is also in flux, you're on the ops team, you're not technically a releaser,
no.
You're on the security team, you're on the technical board, though not the advisory board, so I guess you're, and then you're on the technical team, so you're missing two, but all the other boards... And then that all is in kind of flux because now there's the new technical. So perhaps what is the future going to look like in terms of the organization, right? Because like the term Django core even is tossed around. What do you make of all this for a casual listener?
So
how should they understand?
So about a month ago or something, beginning first half of March or something, we passed the Django enhancement proposal number 10, which essentially states that we want to change how Django is being developed or how the Django community works and how decisions are made and who has, well, I don't want to say the right to do something, but who can eventually, if there's a discussion that doesn't come to a solution or where people can't agree on one of two things, who can make the eventual or final decision to go and like, okay, let's go with this way or another one. And I guess that's one of the things it's been one of the things that's been around and where we've been trying to do that for quite a while, but never really got around that. Now, James Bennett finally managed to actually write down the step, and at that point, the Django core team voted on that, and it was accepted with quite a large number of votes. And yeah, so the future of the Django project is gonna look different. We're trying to open up the decision making processes and make those more visible.
Because the other piece was the DEP 10, and then the core voted on it, and then the Django Software Foundation board, which I'm on, most recent meeting, we approved it. So going forward, I think the idea is that there'll be the technical board and then the one I'm on, which is sort of the non-technical things, as kind of the arbiters of disputes or decisions that arise. Because the next step is an election. Yes. Frank Wiles, who's the president, is going to be setting up the election of technical board members.
Yes. Frankly, I'm not entirely sure about the exact process from the top of my head, because it's a fairly lengthy document. But yeah, we need to.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm privy to. It is a long document, and James has spent a ton of work on it.
Yeah.
Basically, the reason why Frank is going to take that on is because we don't want someone on the technical board to be in charge of the form for voting. But it's just going to be a Google form with the proper permissions.
Yeah.
And
seems like
that will be
probably a good idea
happening. So, but I think part of that is, as you were saying, is public versus private discussion, right?
Because
that's sort of a big thing about. So, what are some examples of why that matters for the Django community?
I think it's Django is an open source project, and we should be able to make decisions in a public forum and make it visible to anybody who wants to contribute to understand the reasoning of how the people who made a decision came to that decision, and seems to be just in the nature of how to do those things. And that making those decisions in public seems to be the right choice.
I think the other part as well is that the term Django core is something that you get and you never lose, even if you're not as active. I mean, because for example, you're incredibly active and there are members who have the title who are not as active. So I believe one of the intents is to, I think that's going to be a legacy thing that can be bestowed, but to have the technical team reflect the current active members as opposed to people who are maybe more active in the past.
Well, the term Django core, or rather Django committer or Django core team member, has been or is a term for somebody who had been given commit access in the past, and it was always kind of once you have it, you don't lose it. Unless you mess up like big time, but I don't think anybody ever did, or you hand it or give it up by yourself. But then these, if you then don't actively participate in the whole development of that, then you still seem to be on this list of people who are in there, and you can still take credit for that position. And sure, when you have contributed in the past a significant amount of work, and that was usually the thing that's kind of led somebody to become a core member, then it's using that position or using that title that you had in the past kind of made sense and seems fine to me. But over the last years, it's been clear that there's not really like this big thing in Django that somebody could do to become a core committer or core member. And the things that you in the past indicated somebody becoming commit access are just not really there anymore. So finding a way to become a core committer wasn't just something that still existed. There wasn't a route to become one. So dropping this whole concept and acknowledging people who had this position in the past, but then essentially dropping this whole position seemed kind of like a better or good way forward.
One part of that is that because the term core was around before there were Django Fellows, because Tim Graham and now Carlton and Marius, in terms of releases at least, they do much of that work for the community.
Yes, so
that's part of the...
Exactly. So in the past, we, with commit access, you were able to commit to the GitHub repository directly. And some people, a small number, I think like three people, had release access, which meant they had the possibility to put packages in PyPI. And with the new change of the DAP 10, this also changed in a way that you don't need to be, we will have a merger role, which is the people who have commit access to the Django repository, and we have a releaser role, which are the people who have access to PyPI and can put packages on PyPI. People can be in both, but they don't have to be. So if you, for example, don't have the time to constantly review and time to merge patches, and specifically review is not necessarily up to the mergers. They should be doing like a check on style and so on, and do a like general review under PR that it makes that whatever is committed or that whatever they commit makes sense. But the discussion if the approach is taken in a PR should be taken by the community and by people who are going to be involved in this change.
Yeah, because you can imagine like, you know, a number of people reviewing the PR, and then the merger is just the person who clicks the button at the end. It's kind of the,
yeah.
You know, I always describe the fellow role as like the janitors, right? We sweep the floor, and that's kind of what we do. Is we just just keep it tidy. I mean, we do reviewing and all that.
I mean, you do more than just being the janitor. You do far more than just being the janitor for the Django project. But yeah, it seems to be a significant role too. To what you're doing.
Well, and I think part of this in general is the reason why that, like, for me on the board and you on the technical board, why we spend time on this is because it's an open source project. Basically, everyone's a volunteer, and we wanted the system to be in place so people can contribute, but not one person has access to everything, for example. And so when people do leave, there's a process, as you said, for new people to come in to be a handoff of knowledge and power. I mean, even, for example... So we added GitHub sponsors to the Django repo, and that's something I worked a lot on. So I have access to part of the Django repo, but I couldn't fill out the form, so I had to get Marius, who's the fellow, because he has, you know, more access. So these layers of permission are important, just in case.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want someone to have the keys to everything, and you want to have a bit of structure, but not so much that it's prohibitive to get anything done.
Yeah.
This is how I think about this. Anyway,
I mean, but things, particularly with access to like PyPI, you know, that's sensitive, right? You can't have a package being uploaded as Django to PyPI if it isn't Django.
Yes, like,
there's too many people depend on it being Django for that to happen.
Exactly. There's opening up the whole thing, opening up the whole contribution process to Django and. Allowing more or less arbitrary people to be voted on to be mergers or releases comes with a side note that we with a perspective and me taking this from a perspective from a more security conscious person right now comes with the problem that we need to trusted person to not put in some like backdoor or whatever in that release package that somebody needs to inspect and find. And so yeah, it's the selection process or the voting process on who becomes them will be open according to the things that are stated in the DAP. But it's definitely also going to be something where the community needs to look out for that not some random malicious person is going to like hijack Django, because that's not going to be a good...
But I was reading the DEP yesterday or the day before. For some reason, I needed to refresh my memory on it. But the qualification to be on, so the technical board have to okay the nomination of mergers and releases for these important roles. But to be a candidate for the technical board, so the technical board will be elected by the DSF members. So already to be in the DSF, you have to be known by the community, right? Anyone can join, but you have to be known by the community.
Well, you can.
You have to be nominated and then approved by the board.
But you can self-nominate.
But then to be a candidate for the,
I think you can self-nominate. But there's, and actually, I'm linking. I wrote a blog post just recently about what the board actually does. There's, I think, 180 or so individual members.
Yeah.
So sorry, continue, Carlton. But that's like the first step of
But not anyone can be on the technical board. You have to have within the last couple of years, a shown history of contributing and reviewing PRs or working on track GitHub or being in the group. So to be a candidate for the technical board is actually quite tough. It's not like any person who isn't known to the community and known to be a contributor could even stand for the technical board. I think the wording in the DEP is actually very conscious of the possible dangers if it were more open. So I'm quite relaxed about it in that sense.
Yeah, it definitely, James definitely put a lot of thought into that part and the other people who contributed in the writing of the DEP. I mean, James did a major part of that, but as again, the discussion on the DEP was held in public on the DEP itself, on the PR.
And it was over a year in discussion, right? It took a long time.
I don't even know. It's taken quite a while.
But that's cool.
So maybe we can talk about some of these hats that you wear, because I hope that there's more of an understanding of the many, many roles that you play in the community. So let's pick security team. So you and Carlton are both in the security team. And I think, what's the process for a normal security release? And then there was the GitHub SQL injection one recently, which I believe you did the commit for, that you all turned around in 2 days, a month or two ago. It was first discovered on GitHub. Right, so what's the normal process? And then I thought that one was particularly impressive, where maybe it was 3 days, but it was discovered, the commit was done, and it was released.
Yeah.
And that,
so the usual...
I thought that was cool.
Thank you. the usual process for security thing is usually that, well, somebody reports either on HackerOne or on a security mailing list or a security reporting list, security@djangoproject.com, reports a security issue or a suspected security issue. Like, rather be conscious and like think this might be an issue, report it, and then we go, like, actually, that's not. But that's, we much rather have that than somebody just putting something open into the open, like, oh shit, this is something that we should have like fixed now. So you usually report something in a private way, and then people on the security team are going to review that. Is it an issue? Is it like, do we need to fix it like now, or do we have time to rethink the whole approach we have there? We then usually talk to the reporter and try to figure out who's going to write the patch, who's going to review the patch. Like, we love for reporters to also contribute to patch, and then the people on the security team reviewing it. But if they feel like, I don't really feel like writing the patch, then somebody on the team is going to write the patch, and we then hand out the patch or the proposed patch to the reporter and ask them to apply that and see that this actually fixes their bug in their well, probably production environment that they have there. This maybe goes a bit back and forth. Once we are done with that, we pre-notify a set of organizations, companies, of an upcoming security list, security release. We also pre-notify the on the Django announce mailing list that there will be a security release on a with a given date and time. And then at that point, well, usually Carlton or Marius are going to commit the patches to the Django repository and issue the corresponding releases and announce the release. Now,
and that's
yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say about that commits, because it's like potentially sensitive, and on that morning of the release, and so we've got a time, and it's like we've got the patches ready, and they say we're going to have to, you know, we just dropped 1.11 from extended support, but the time we were supporting Django 1.11, Django 2.2, Django 3.0, and you have to merge those patches onto the branches, and then within a short period get the release out and the announcement out, because once you've merged them, those patches are public, and so that it's kind of like you have to get all the pieces lined up, and it's a little bit tense, you know. It's much harder than a normal release, which you can, you know, you take your time over.
Yeah.
Carry on, Marcus. You were saying so we've.
Yeah, this is. I can definitely understand that. Like, issuing a security release is a whole different story, just from the mental capacity that's involved there, because you can't, like, a usual release you can go like, oh yeah, we broke whatever in there, we just gonna just don't install the new version, like pin something to before, and then like take the time to fix this bug and or revert it and issue another one. But if that happens with a security release, you go like, oh damn, well, we just published a security issue which we don't have a working patched version for. And you go like, this is not ideal. So the other issue that you brought up with the with a GitHub SQL engine wasn't, I think it was like this.
Oh, it was an account hijack. It was an account, a potential account hijack. Right.
Yes. Yeah, it was like the password. That's what.
Password reset. Yeah, something like that.
It was like a Unicode character or something too. You could shove something in there.
Yes.
Well, you guys actually worked on it. I'm just sitting here like talking over you. You did the work.
The issue was that if you get a domain with Unicode characters in, which sort of lowercase comparisons to, you know, with certain database backends to another domain. So, you know, it could be google.com, but the O's are funny Unicode characters, and then it would look like it was a Google email, but in fact
it wasn't.
A Google email.
In that case, if like the issue itself is known, then you don't really need to treat it as a sensitive or private issue anymore, because the moment where those security issues are known and possibly exploits are known, a bunch of smart people are going to look through all the code bases out there and trying to find projects that or code bases that are vulnerable. And at that point, this time between announcement and pre-notification is just, well, kind of wasted time, because we should instead have that time people already fixing their installations.
Yes, normally we give 7 days, but you can't give 7 days when there's a hot exploit out in the wild.
So yeah, in this case, we just dropped the pre-notification. We issued the release on May.
Pre-notify by a day, I think.
Yeah, something like that.
I was just going to say, for Carlton and I often beat the drum of keep your Django version up to date. And even if you're using an LTS, you should do the minor releases, the security releases, for this reason, because otherwise you won't get the security updates.
Yes.
If you're on a version that's in extended support, then it's definitely a, you know, if there's a point release, you definitely want that. Like,
yes, there is.
Yeah, because I think
it's either data
people...
loss or it's security. You want that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Let's go down the list. Ops team. So you and I have had some. I've been emailing around that. Maybe we don't need to discuss some of that, but what does the ops team do? Like, what is the ops infrastructure of Django itself? So you're on there along with Florian, Tobias, and Carlton.
Well, we have this website, and you probably have heard of it, djangoproject.com, and that needs to run somewhere. And, well, we also have a CI, continuous integration, that we use for testing Django, which is run on DjangoCI.com. And turns out when you run websites, you need some servers or something in the backend that does work. We kind of maintain that the software, or the not necessarily software there, but the infrastructure. Like, we keep Jenkins up to date. Usually, we when there's fixes to the Django website, we deploy them. These kinds of things.
Yeah, well, it's I think another sort of unsung role in the broader community, but quite a bit of work is done. And so for me on the board, what's as the treasurer, is what's relevant is there's some costs involved with that. So I monitor and help pay those. Rackspace has been sort of the major contributor the last few years, yeah, who provides the servers. They've been very generous with that.
Yeah.
So just another one of these things that's happening in the background that makes Django happen. And you, Marcus, are very involved with. So I wanted to call that out.
Thank you.
I have a long list of things to ask you about, but maybe let's talk about your day job, right? You work at Crate.io, which is IoT scale database. Can you
tell us
all that means?
Yeah. IoT scale database. Explain that.
That's not you. That's the headline on the website.
Yeah, it's the headline on the website, which is fine. So we built a database for the IoT market. So IoT is usually time series data. So something, numbers usually, or maybe some added labels to that, and then a timestamp. And you want to aggregate data from usually, or in the market we are focusing on is the industrial IoT. So you have factories that companies have where they equip their production lines with sensors, or the machines in themselves are already equipped with sensors, and you want to do analytics on those machines, and you want to understand when something goes wrong. And in order to do analytics, you need to store the data somewhere and then aggregate things. And turns out when you have a lot of plants or manufacturing lines and machines and a lot of data and a lot of numbers, then you need to have a database that can cope with that. And yeah, with CrateDB, we have a database that's based on Lucene, scales fairly well, pretty much almost linearly for, I don't know, even know how many nodes, and can cope with ridiculous numbers of records and tables. And yeah, it's a SQL database after all. So you still write your SQL statements and it returns the records.
So why not Postgres, right? Obviously, there's a lot more that Postgres can't do, which is why you work there and you have this product. But if I start a Django project that's IoT and I'm using Postgres, where do I see that, I need something better or bigger like Crate? Like, do you have a sense of where that friction comes up?
So one of the things with Postgres is that it's transactional, for example. Like, I'm not even sure if you can run Postgres without transactions. I suppose you can't. I guess you can't. You probably also don't want to, that said. CrateDB, on the other hand, is eventually consistent. And you have kind of multi-master, or you don't really have a master node in your cluster. You have a single node that holds at the particular set of time, or at the current time, holds an information about the whole cluster, but that's known to every other node. But you can write to every node in your cluster, connect to every node, write to every node, read from every node, and it's more or less self-balancing with the data if you don't screw up your table creation. Go ahead.
Is the advantage of that is that ingest speed? You can pull in the rate at which you can ingest data is just...
Yes. It's
order of magnitude higher.
It's orders of magnitude higher. I don't even know the exact numbers that we are currently looking at with some of our benchmarkings. But it's... Sure, you can scale your Postgres ridiculously high and improve a whole bunch of inserts. But at some point, you're going to run into issues. And then, for the most part, in Crate, you just add two more nodes to your cluster. The just in quotes, because it's like just in IT is never going to be a you can simply, again, in quotes. But it's
that's like tutorials. I always try to put simply, just simply install Django.
Exactly.
It goes over well.
But yeah, for the most part, it's you add a node or two or five and your cluster has more storage space. Your cluster has more throughput, aggregation capabilities, memory, all these things.
And so the other question, you said eventually consistency. So how long does that take? Because I've used eventually consistent data stores, and quite often that just means where's my data? You do a write, and then you do a get to get it back, and it's like not found. And you're like, hang on, I just inserted it, and you said it worked. Where is it? How long does that take to run through, say? If I guess it depends on the size of your class, but...
I think it's sub-milliseconds or in milliseconds area. But like, you're not going to wait 5 minutes for this number to show up somewhere. If your entire network is completely overloaded, for sure it's going to take time, but then you may want to reconsider your network infrastructure.
Spin up that extra node you talked about.
Yeah. Adding more nodes also means more communication.
Right. And you said it was based on Lucene, which means the thing that comes to mind is, well, Elasticsearch. How does it compare to Elasticsearch? Because I know a lot of people use that for high ingest use cases.
Yes. In the very early stages of CrayDB, it was merely a plugin on top of Elasticsearch that provided the SQL interface, which over time became not a fork of Elastic, but had a bunch of code from Elastic that was used, and then we had our own stuff around that or melded it into the whole thing, and that made up CrayDB at that point. And then eventually, last year, I guess, I think we dropped the core team there dropped Elastic in that sense that it's not in the code base anymore. So I'm not involved in the direct development of the database itself.
Fair enough.
So I can't actually tell you that much about the details of the development there and the specifics around the code.
But are you aware of the sort of general, like, what was it that Elastic didn't scale in a particular way, or do you happen to know that? Maybe you don't, I don't know. It's just interesting.
I'm not entirely sure, to be honest.
Okay, fair enough. It was just,
Well, and you, I think your master's studies, you did some work on Elasticsearch, right? So that's back in 2014, along with Alex?
No.
No? Oh, oops, sorry. I got the wrong... I was looking up... I pulled up... Wait, oh, weird. I'm sorry. I was just quickly pulling up... it's on your...
My master's...
Yes, with Alexander Griebert, because I saw you had a talk on Elasticsearch, and I was just trying to pull it up, and
I,
it pulls up...
I did give...
From 2014, you have a whole post on it.
So I saw you...
Oh,
I saw you give a very good talk on Elasticsearch.
It was just one course at uni where we... So all my studies, I always, with all the projects that I had to do, I always tried to use yet another technology just to like play around with it. And went from C, C++, Java, eventually Python, and then in the master's in that one course, and this one blog post, I guess you're referring to, with the school data in Berlin, we figured, hey, how about we just build a static website and then throw all the data we have into Elastic and just query that straight from the front end. But that's about it, what I did with Elastic there. Thing I think you, Carton, referred to was a talk I gave...
Well, I saw... In Heidelberg.
Was it Heidelberg? Yes, probably. What was it?
Well, let me summarize what I remember. And
I've got it here. It's combining Django and Elasticsearch.
Have
the slides up. We'll link to it.
It was this great talk about how you can use the Django ORM and write... that, and then how you would sync to Elasticsearch to do your information retrieval, your search queries. And I remember it being so good, because I at the time I was flirting with this idea that, oh, we'll just drop the ORM layer. If we're going to sync everything to Elasticsearch and search from Elasticsearch, and even we're going to serve the web pages perhaps from Elasticsearch, why not just write to Elasticsearch and not bother with the Django ORM at all? And you were like, no, because you lose the transaction handling, you lose the ORM, you lose all these. And you're exactly right. And I was like, yeah, that's answered that question canonically for me.
Yeah, I looked up the talk. It's on the lookout for your data from DjangoCon Europe in Heidelberg. You're right. There's 2018.
But that's a great video, folks. You must watch that on YouTube.
Yeah.
Link in the show notes.
Well, the other talk project that I wanted to, that I was saw of yours recently was the logging article where you talk through Django and logging at a really deep level, but then you just casually link to this GitLab repo that's amazing, where you have all these examples of how to structure your logs in different applications, which we'll link to. Like, because I put up code open source sometimes, and you got a lot of good stuff in here, right? You have like an airline example, a bank example.
That's
and you just sort of casually mention at the end, like, I would just like make a video of that, being like, check this out. It's a lot of work to make that.
It's been a top this so the topic there in this talk is about structured logging. And
yeah, structured.
I could recite parts of the talk now, but I'm not gonna do that. I suppose you can put the link to the talk somewhere in the description or in the links. I fear I'm gonna spoil the surprise of this talk, but
okay. Well, I was really impressed that you actually have code to back it up, which I always like. Like, it's not just talking; it's like you gave examples.
The parts you mentioned there with airline and so on. It's the reason for that is because of the title and the whole story of how I try to bring this whole title of the talk into a why you would want to do structured logging, and with that refers to a movie.
Okay, we'll put the link up for everyone, so we won't ruin it. Or maybe we could talk about Django 3.1.
The two things I'm excited about is the async view. So okay, 3.0 had the ASCII handler, which enabled you to embed Django in a ASCII environment. So that's the foundation step, but 3.1 is the start where you can actually write an async def view. And okay, that's going to be basic, and that's going to be fledgling as what we'll be able to do in future. But it's like, yes. So now, if I've got my Django project, I need to make a few API calls out, and they could be done in parallel without even running a different server. Still with Gunicorn, still in the WSGI environment, I can write a parallelized view which fetches those rather than having to do those sequentially, and that will be much quicker. And that's just a quick gain without having to do anything else. So, this is the real start for, yeah, we can start to do these extra exciting things. And okay, there aren't going to be the async class-based views yet that we'll probably get in a few, when we all learn how to write these views and we all learn what the patterns are, yep. Django support will evolve. But this is like this is the real async bit. This is the bit where we're like, yeah, actually, and most of what you can do,
will be possible. And then one of the next versions, we need this 3-point the async for database level, I guess, because that's still not there.
Yeah,
right?
So this is the limitation: is if you're still using the ORM, that still needs to be wrapped in a sync wrapper and executed in a thread. So a lot of the things you want to do, they'll still be sync.
Yeah,
but I mean, Andrew Godwin, who wrote the views PR. We merged it, and he's quickly joking, oh, right, now the ORM. It's like,
right, exactly.
It's going to be exciting, I think. I'm excited. I've been right for years. I've had to spin out a Node.js on the side. Before Django had async, before Python had async,
yeah.
You'd have to spin up a JavaScript thing to do something async. And then Python's had async for a little while with async.io and, there are other options, but async.io being the standard library option. And you think, okay, well, I can just do it with async.io, fine, brilliant. And there are a couple of web frameworks around that that we've talked about, Tom Christie's Starlet,
yes.
as a go-to there. But to not even have to change a web framework to do the basic thing, that's more and more civilized
cool.
all the time.
That's pretty cool, absolutely.
And I think because Flask is working on this, but it's sort of like totally different things too. So not that it's a competition, but I hope to get, I guess, David Lord or someone on from Flask to talk about how they're doing it. But it's going to be another reason that Django just marches into the future. And, you know, when they, people say async, yeah, you can do that. Though, of course, like, in Andrew's talks, to me, the interesting thing is the use cases for async aren't as ubiquitous as maybe we thought they would, or the community thought they would be 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Like that to me is sort of the interesting piece. I mean, you know, in the same way that we have HTTP2, but it's not, aside from gaming and chat, maybe, well, perhaps in, you know, in IoT cases it's being used, but it's not used everywhere.
The interesting part about, or the part about async is that it's really giving you a lot of benefit and when you have a lot of IO. And frankly,
yes,
most websites and should chat and all these things, they are not particularly normal websites in that sense, because there's a whole part of this media part in there. But regular websites, it's, well, here's my view that fetches a few things from the database and returns a bunch of HTML for the most part, or returns an API, a bunch of stuff in a JSON response or as an API. There's not really a lot of IO happening when you compare it to a bunch of other scenarios. And yeah, you may get a bit of speed up here and there, but occasionally I think that the mental overhead that you need to apply there in order to wrap your head around async can easily reduce the maintainability of the of that page then.
Yeah.
Comes with pros and cons. It's pretty much everything.
Yeah, in the PR there was a note Andrew put, I'm sure it's there, it must be, otherwise I wouldn't be sure. But there was a note saying something like, we advise you to keep using sync until you've profiled and you know that there's a real you know, benefit here. Don't just jump onto the async bandwagon because you think it's cool. I mean, it is cool, but that's not a reason to build your product in it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely an interesting approach and interesting way of writing code. And I mean, the whole front end part in web has approached that for a while now and has been doing async for quite a while. But then in the front end, you have direct user interactions where you want to do bubbles here and show things there asynchronously, which you don't really have in a web server backend with like APIs for the most part anyway.
Yeah, I mean, there's some, was it live, call it live view. So there was the Phoenix project, which is in Elixir. They've got a thing called live view, and then somebody's ported that to Django. There's a Django live view project, which is really interesting. I think they're using channels under the back. But what's nice about it is that a form can do validation on the server side, because it's doing what looks like local client-side JavaScript validation in the form, but it's actually pinging the server and getting the response there.
Yeah.
And one of the issues with writing decent JavaScript has always been, oh, I've got to rewrite my validation logic, and you know, it's always been a bit of a
a pain. There's the Batavia project from the PyBe project, which aims at providing Python in the browser through I was going to say cross compiling to JavaScript.
Just a WASM, is it?
I'm not entirely sure, or I don't entirely remember how they built the whole thing, but essentially can write Python code, and then they have a Python. Yeah, what they have is essentially a Python runtime, so no compiler or something, or REPL. It's just the interpreter. That you throw some Python bytecode at, and the interpreter is written in JavaScript, so it runs in the browser, and then you run this Python bytecode in the browser.
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
So
that's part of the Beware project,
part of
right?
Beware, yes.
Yeah, I was going to say, Russell's, I think he referred to that in his keynote at PyCon last year, too, where...
Probably, yes.
That specific, yeah. Well, maybe for me, like a final question. So this is something I was hoping to do in person at DjangoCon Europe, but since we're in a virtual situation, So sitting on the board, a lot of what we do is the janitorial side of Django, paying the bills. But one of the things I want to do is be a little bit more aggressive around if we had a grant fellowship, if we, you know, didn't have to rely on Kickstarters for major new features, what would be some features that you think would be good for Django to add, assuming we had unlimited people and money? You know, are there a couple that come to mind between the two of you? I mean, authentication is a big one,
yes,
right?
That so I comes guess out. Contrib Auth could use an overhaul, let's call it that, make it a bit more modern and adjust it to a few modern security or authentication processes, like stuff like OAuth or two-factor or in whichever way authentication. I think the thing that's been on the docket for ever is a new admin. There's this...
Well, right. It's just $1 million, right?
Exactly.
They did the cost benefit.
I don't even remember who brought this number up. I have the feeling this was...
I think it was Jacob.
It was Jacob at Django Under the Hood, I think. Yeah, if we have $1 million and a few folks, I think he mentioned 10 people or so that spent a year, then this is achievable or something like that. yeah.
well, I
like the big one on my list is the auth. I'd like to see two-factor auth built in. I'd like an easy solution for users to be able to, you know, have one-time passwords, have, you know,
yeah,
all the other bits and bobs that come.
Other things that's been... go ahead, Carlton.
No, well, that's my one sort of battery. There are other things that we could add, like nice little features that would improve it in a number of ways. But my one big missing battery at this point is 2FA of some kind, a modern,
yeah,
you know, use your smartphone with its bio registering security, yeah, measures, and know that it's you that's logging in.
Yeah.
I think we could do that now. It's a big job, but
it's another thing that's been floating around in a fairly long time, and I think kind of was dropped to a degree once the whole channels on Django channels came around, and absolutely once it was clear that Django itself is going to have some async capabilities, is a API for task execution. So not the execution built into Django, but an API where you give go and like, I want to send off this task and do thing, and then whatever implementation project or whatever project is out there that wants to implement that can use and can build on top of that. So your just to pick one, Celery Django integration would leverage that task this task interface that Django could leverage that task interface that Django uses, and you define whatever this one setting in your in Django or in Celery, and it again, quote unquote, just works. But the idea is that you could replace Celery with whatever RQ or I don't even know what else is out there.
But you might have an SQS backend, you might have a Redis backend, you might have a, you know.
Well, that might not even be the level of where the integration goes, but it's been floating around like 5 years ago or something. I remember having a discussion with that in Cardiff at the DjangoCon. So that was 2015.
Right.
Well, I hope that this is something that I hope to encourage more in the community, because on the DSF side and as treasurer, if someone said, we need this new feature, raise X amount of money, there's a number of ways we can get that money. So I don't want that to be the limiting factor. I hope to encourage that, you know, we don't rely on Kickstarters, but it's sort of the chicken and egg where, I mean, because the total budget for the Django Software Foundation is around $200,000. Most of it goes to the fellows, then to conference workshop sponsorship, and then a teeny tiny amount for the ops and whatever, and that's it, because we don't need more, and we're not trying to raise a ton of money. But if some feature was $50,000, you know, whether it's getting a grant from Google, which has provided help, or some of these corporations, or there's a number of other ways we can
try to raise money. You
know, we can raise money in a way that doesn't go against any of the principles of Django, but we need to know that we need it. Yeah. Is the first step. So
That kind of brings us full circle, because one of the things I'm really excited about the DEP 10, which is the change to Django's governance, is that the technical board are meant to have a new role of helping to guide the technical direction of Django, and to each major release to sort of take a bit of time, solicit ideas, compile those ideas into a bit more of a feature roadmap, because we've got this time-based release and we'll keep that. But the technical board will hopefully be able to lay down some, look, we're aiming to improve contrib auth. We're aiming to, introduce a back-end system. If that's what the technical board come to the conclusion with, consulting with the community, then we will have that that list of ideas, which are that list of things we want, which then, DSF board or the membership can act on.
Yes, absolutely. But that also requires like ideas from outside, or from people using Django, or from people in the community. So to go and like, hey, this would be cool. And then while I guess for some obvious reasons, we can't do all the things, and we probably shouldn't do all the things, but like the things that are useful for the majority of people, where there's a possibility to build a API in Django or build the bits and pieces into Django that then third-party applications can use and leverage that to build the more sophisticated parts to be used as applications. I guess that's definitely something where we definitely will rely on need to rely on the community to bring up ideas there.
So one of the things I'd like to do this year is to do a Django survey again, which I think Tim Graham did in 2015, something like that, similar to the Python survey, where in addition to asking people how they use Django, we could have a place to say, what would you like to see, in part based on your use case at your company? Because we're sort of getting at is that a lot of the times we're flying blind in terms of Django usage, because we don't track.
Yeah.
We don't have tracking in there. So we don't really know a company's using Django unless there's something open source or someone from there tells us by design. But that does limit sometimes the new features and things that we can add.
Yes, absolutely. This, I know there was a discussion around integrating some kind of usage tracking in Django, which was, I think, fairly strictly, let's call it shut down by the core team.
Yes.
I think there's a dApp out there, dApp proposal, 4 years old. I'm guessing here.
Yeah, I think it was shut down. Because you can see on PyPI, you can see the number of Django downloads, but the PyPI stats are, there's many ways that those are unreliable, actually.
Yeah.
So I think our take to be conscious of privacy and all these things is the right one, but it does mean it takes a little more work to find out how people are using it. Jeff Triplett and I are trying to, or Jeff Triplett's been working on a list of like the top 500 companies using Django. And it's a bit of work to find that, in part so we know who they are, that we can ask them around features. We could, try to suggest sponsorships and stuff. But we have no idea who they are, without doing the work,
so
the manual work.
The DEP I was mentioning is DEP 8, Gathering Django Usage Analytics.
It's difficult. Commercial companies obviously often put this kind of analytics in there. In their packages, you download VS Code, it's got analytics, which goes back to Microsoft. That's not necessarily a problem. You opt into all of that and you know about it. But
perhaps
it's not something Django's going to have, is it?
I think we could message. For me, we could totally read. We could look through Django project in general from scratch with fresh eyes, have a docs fellow or team. I think there's a lot of ways that we could improve that and talk about a lot of the things that Django project and team members are doing that we don't spend the time talking about rather than just doing.
But it's capacity as well. There's a group of contributors who are very active and there's new people coming in and, some come and stay, some come for a bit and leave, some come for a bit, leave, come back again. everybody's working quite hard on keeping Django moving, and it moves fast. You know, look at the last few releases. They've all been, you know, just major, great releases.
Well, yeah, and that's, and I hope that
and the project.
I want to call out more attention to the people doing that work, because I know that everyone who's on, you know, our mailing list knows who one another is, but most people don't know. And I, not that people do it for that reason, but I think it's important to, as to your talks, Carlton, right? We need new contributors. There's a lot of strength, but there's quite a bit of fragility when it's a half dozen people doing, you know, two of you are on this call, are doing a lot of the work.
Fortunately,
for modern
it's
Django.
A remote call. It's a video call. So if a meteor strikes one location, this would be awesome.
But anyways, but I mean, certainly I view my, you know, my role on the board as being a janitorial, a support role for the core, you know, the technical team and trying to enable that.
But yeah, I mean, okay, that's a good point to wrap up, because Marcus, thank you for your work on the ops team, on the security team, on the technical board, and everywhere you're around at Django Cons and on the community as well.
Thanks, Will, Carlton, for having me. Thanks, everybody, for still contributing to Django and keeping this project running. It's a pretty impressive what's happened for the last, what is this, 16 years now?
15, 16?
Yeah, something like, give or take. Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
It's quite a while.
It's going to be a few more yet, one thinks.
Yes.
All right, thanks again. All right, and everybody, we're at Chat Django on Twitter, djangochat.com, and links to everything in the show notes.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Join us next time. Bye-bye.